Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker will be James J. Kimball, Associate Professor of Communications and the Arts at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey, Book Review Editor for the Presidential Studies Quarterly, and author of Prairie Forge, The Extraordinary Story of the Nebraska Scrap Metal Drive of World War II. He'll speak on the topic Scrapper-in-Chief, How Henry Dorley Unified a State and Helped Win a War. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 18, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Betty Davis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
I met Jim when he first came to Omaha to do research for a project that now has become a book and a DVD, and it's a remarkable story about patriotism in Nebraska that started here but spread to the entire nation. The title of his talk will deal with that, and it's Scrapper in Chief, How Henry Dorley Unified a State and Helped Win a War. The interesting part is it was enjoyable, competitive, and it truly did help win a war. Dr. Kimball is a native of Norfolk, Nebraska. He's very proud of Nebraska. He is now Associate Professor of Communications and the Arts at Seton Hall University, as well as Book Review Editor of the Presidential Studies Quarterly. He will talk on the Nebraska Plan, as it was known, and it was an astonishing drive begun by Henry Dorley in 1942. He will tell you that it not only was instrumental in helping win the war, but it exemplified what it meant to be a Nebraskan. And what better bit of patriotism could we have at this time, in this month approaching July 4th, and the day that we really celebrate our own patriotism. Thank you for coming, and I'm very pleased and want you to join me in welcoming Dr. Kimball to Omaha, Nebraska.
Thank you. Well, I thought we might begin today by synchronizing our watches. We're going to be traveling back in time for a while today. I want to make sure that everyone comes back safe and sound here to 2015. So hopefully you've all brought your DeLoreans. We're headed back to 1942. In 1942, the first helicopter is tested. The Voice of America begins operations. In the Oscar category, How Green Was My Valley wins Best Picture. The Ad Council, founder of Smokey Bear, is founded. Walt Disney's Bambi has its premiere in London. And plutonium is isolated at the University of Chicago. So it's a pretty eventful year in a lot of ways. And, of course, there's a war going on at the same time. Here in Nebraska in 1942, we are a witness to one of the most amazing events in state history, as well as one of the most amazing movements in national history. It is an earth-shattering event known nationally as the Nebraska Plan. It brought an entire nation together as never before. It astonished the world, and its effects reverberated across the various battlefronts in World War II. And back of it all was a 61-year-old newspaper publisher, an adopted Nebraskan, and one of Omaha's most memorable citizens, as well as, incidentally, a member of the Hall of Fame of this very organization, and that was Henry Dorley, who might just have fired the shot that changed the course of World War II, and he fired it right here in downtown Omaha. In fact, my research into the scrap metal drive suggests that without Dorley's Nebraska Plan, the Allies could potentially have lost World War II. And even if they had won, absent the scrap metal drive, the victory would have taken much longer, perhaps years longer, to actually win. Now, at this point, you probably are wondering to yourself, now, wait a second, how did Jim get from an Omaha publisher to the outcome of the biggest war in history? That's a pretty big leap. Well, some of you are familiar with the old poem. It goes something like this. For want of a nail, the horseshoe was lost. For want of a horseshoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the message was lost. For want of a message, the battle was lost. And for want of the battle, the war was lost. I believe that Henry Dorley, in particular, made sure that that horseshoe nail was not lost. And he did that here in Omaha, Nebraska. As a result, I believe that we should remember his contribution as well as the contributions of those many Nebraskans who bought into his vision. And today, here at the Omaha Press Club, and thank you all for inviting me to speak before you, I want to defend that argument. The title is Scrapper in Chief: How Henry Dorley United a State and Helped to Win a War. And the defense, as Betty mentioned earlier, emerges from my research for the book Prairie Forge, as well as the documentary Scrappers: How the Heartland Won World War II. Now, like any argument, we need some underlying structure to help figure out exactly how we're going to support it. And so the rough plan that I have for this talk today goes as follows. First, I'll talk a little bit about the scrap emergency itself. Who in the world cares about rusted piles of scrap? I'll tell you why. In the second section, we'll look at Henry Dorley himself and his newspaper, the World Herald, and what they brought to the scrap metal emergency table. Third, we'll look at Dorley's idea, the Nebraska Plan, which eventually, in the fall of 1942, turned into the National Scrap Drive, which one participant dubbed the greatest treasure hunt in history. And finally, in a short epilogue, we'll return in our DeLoreans back to 2015, and we'll look back a little bit and consider some of the ways that we here in Nebraska are remembering the scrap drive, or perhaps failing to remember. So, are you ready for our journey? Our DeLoreans are all warmed up. All right, so we'll start off with the scrap emergency. Now, if we look back from the perspective of 2015, and you read your history books, you know without a doubt the Allies won the war. There's no question. You can't go back and change the history. But if you would, for a second, put yourself in the shoes of someone in the middle of 1942. There are no history books at that time saying who is going to win the war. You don't know how it's going to turn out. In fact, it seems that there was a very real possibility that the Allies could have lost World War II. Think about the battles to that point in the war, from the American perspective. In mid-1942, the only convincing American victory was at Midway in the Pacific, and even that was a pretty close battle, it turned out. Otherwise, American troops were either not yet in the field, still in training or embarking, or had suffered historic losses, as at Pearl Harbor and at Bataan. The Roosevelt administration was well aware of the dire situation in terms of the war outcome. In August 1942, the Office of War Information's director, Elmer Davis, wrote for public consumption a column in which his main point was as follows: we could lose this war. Think about that message from an official of the Roosevelt administration. That's pretty stark words. Why did he say that? He went on to say, production measured against military needs is not enough for victory. The arsenal of democracy, in other words, was producing lots of munitions, but it needed far, far more than it was making in mid-1942. So what was the problem? The key reason for the stuttering war machine to that point was relatively simple. The supply of scrap metal for use in steel factories was declining, and it was declining rapidly. And why was that so? The reason was that the open hearth method of making steel was the default U.S. system at the time, and it still is, And that process requires, when you're making steel, approximately 50% iron ore dug up from the ground and 50% scrap metal. If you take a look at the visual on the screen, you can see a rough schematic of how the American system produces ingot steel. There are two different primary phases. The first involves a blast furnace. Into the blast furnace go measures of iron ore, limestone, coal, and scrap metal. What comes out on the other side is known as pig iron. And pig iron is a useful product, but not really for fighting war. It's too brittle, and so you couldn't use it to build a tank or the hull of a ship or anything like that. It has to be processed further with additional raw materials, additional iron ore, additional limestone, some ferroalloys, and another half ton of scrap metal. All of that goes into a steel furnace, also known as an open hearth furnace, and on the other side, you've produced a ton of ingot steel. So you can see that scrap metal comes into the process at two different points. Approximately 50% of every finished steel product is scrap. And you can't fight a total war without steel products. Now, in peacetime, this system was really not a problem. When you had a steel product that became obsolescent in some way, so your car rusted out, you could simply turn it into the local junk peddler who would take it to a junkyard or a salvage yard, where it would be sorted and processed and returned back to the factories to be melted down to be reused again. So it's a continuous cycle of sorts. But everything changes during war. In peacetime, prior to World War II, America had so much excess scrap that it actually exported it to the highest bidder. And by the way, who do you think the highest bidder was? Japan. Bought millions of tons of scrap from America in the late 1930s. And a lot of that came back to visit America at Pearl Harbor. So in the war itself, the need for scrap jumps up tremendously, and the peacetime cycle simply isn't enough to catch up. Consider some of the testimony about this crisis of the highest order. This gentleman, you can see on the visual there, is Robert Woolcott, the president of the Lucan Steel Company. And he says, in the middle of 1942, "We are going to end up this year having produced 5 million tons less than our national capacity. And this can be laid to the inadequacy of the supply of scrap in the hands of steel mills." And he said that publicly, so people would have been able to read about that in their newspapers. Less publicly were some of the more dire implications of this problem. Some steel factories were actually beginning to slow down or shut down altogether. For example, 1 month after Pearl Harbor, this gentleman, Representative Kerwin of Ohio, wrote a letter to FDR. To my knowledge, the letter was never published, although it remains in the FDR archives in Hyde Park. He said, "Mr. President, when I made a personal tour of the steel mills over the holidays, I was amazed to find that in Youngstown alone, 9 open hearth furnaces, which manufacture 2,200 tons of steel each day, have been closed down and are not operating due to the lack of scrap." That is a stunning development in a nation newly at war. To give you one other instance of how bad it was, in June 1942, the Republic Steel Corporation records note that its scrap stores were so shallow that its production fell behind by 173,000 tons. That's enough steel to construct 3 Iowa-class battleships. And they were never made because that's how far behind they fell. So you can see that there is a problem. There is some good news. There is some scrap. The scrap is out there. That's the good news. There are millions of tons all across the United States, in basements, in attics, in farm lots, just about anywhere you can imagine old pieces of metal in piles or abandoned somewhere, it's going to be there. The bad news is that we have to gather it, bring it in, sort it, and process it. And who do you think is going to do all the finding and gathering? The American people. So That's what the government tried to do in the first 8 months of 1942. The Roosevelt administration did everything it could to try to convince Americans how important scrap was and how they should personally go out into their fields, attics, backyards, and wherever, find that scrap and bring it in. And unfortunately, it failed miserably. Not until the fall of 1942, in September and October, when Americans in 3 weeks gathered 5 million tons of scrap metal in the most successful drive of the entire war, did the fortunes of the scrap industry change. So how did we get from point A to point B, from a failed national effort where Americans are more or less ignoring the Roosevelt administration's pleas to gather scrap, to the successful national drive in the fall of 1942? Well, to answer that question, let's move forward to the second area that I'll talk about this afternoon, Henry Dorley and the World Herald. So our focus will now shift over to Omaha. Now, how many people here, when you hear the name Henry Dorley, automatically think, zoo? All right, I will confess, that was me before 2005. When I came across an interesting document in the Duke University archives that told me a lot more about Henry Dorley, the city of Omaha, and the state of Nebraska. And I'll get to that story in a little bit. But for now, let's talk a little bit about Dorley, who was unquestionably a real person, and given his central importance in this story, I think it's important that we get to know him just a little bit more. Henry Dorley was born in 1879. That's the same year that Albert Einstein was born, Leon Trotsky, Will Rogers, so he's some influential company. He was not an American at birth. He was born on Barbados, an island in the Caribbean, which at the time was an English colony. Thus, he was born a subject of Queen Victoria herself. On the island, his education was as a civil engineer. But at the age of 19, in 1898, he decided that the opportunities presented to him as a civil engineer on the island were not enough, and so he immigrated to the United States. Here he worked for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and ultimately worked in construction as an engineer for the Union Pacific. And naturally, when you work for the UP, sooner or later you usually end up in Omaha. And so he found himself in Omaha, where he met an attractive young woman. Margaret Hitchcock was a member of a very influential family here in Omaha. Her grandfather had been an early governor of Nebraska, and her father was the founder of the Omaha World Herald and would ultimately become a U.S. senator for 2 terms. So she meets Henry, they begin courting, and in 1904 they are married. Now, the father-in-law, the founder of the World Herald, is Gilbert Hitchcock. Incidentally, he is also a member of the Hall of Fame of this organization. He invites his son-in-law to work at the newspaper, and he doesn't get the benefit of being the son-in-law in that he starts sort of at the bottom of the totem pole. He begins as a crime reporter, and he hates it, and apparently he's very bad at it. One of his memories, unpleasant memories of the time when he was serving as a crime reporter, was the police teasing him because of his accent. He had a British accent because of being a British subject. In fact, the police teased him so much they gave him a nickname behind his back. They called him the Duke, which he didn't like that either. Well, eventually, it was clear that Dorley wasn't going to make much progress as a crime reporter, so the father-in-law, Gilbert, moved Henry to the advertising department, and there Dorley prospered. A few years later, the father-in-law, Gilbert, left for service in Congress, and he took a big risk. He left the hands of the World Herald, or he left the World Herald in the hands of Henry Dorley, who was relatively unproven at that time. Fortunately for the World Herald, Henry turned out to be a pretty good publisher, and by 1934, a couple of decades later, circulation had jumped from, in the early days, 30,000 to a circulation of 120,000. So they were very successful under Dorley's leadership. What kind of person was Dorley? You see conflicting accounts of his personality. I found some accounts that suggested that he was an austere person, no nonsense, that there was no screwing around in the newsroom when Dorley was present, because he would get after you. But others remembered him as an extremely generous person who cared about his employees to the point that when employees would approach him if they were in financial distress, he had no problems offering them interest-free loans until they were able to get out of their financial situation. So I think that speaks well of him in his memory. Just a quick glimpse of a situation that he played into in the 1920s that can give us an idea of his personality and his sense of humor, I think. And this took place in the 1920s when there was a fierce race for readership in Omaha between the Omaha World Herald and the Omaha Bee. And this competition went back and forth and each tried to up the other. One day to get ahead, Dorley decided that he was going to spend extra money for the World Herald to begin publishing the New York stock listings on a daily basis. It cost additional funds for him to be able to do that. And sure enough, a couple of days later, the Omaha Bee began publishing them as well. But Dorley got suspicious. He thought to himself, I think they're looking at our newspaper, and they're copying the stock listings directly from our pages so they don't have to pay for them. So he came up with a plan. A couple of days later, he produced a fake stock listing, SBTB, and placed it in with all of the other stock listings so that it wasn't all that noticeable. And sure enough, the Bee began publishing all those stock listings, including SBTB, whereupon the next day's World Herald had a wonderful story about how the Bee had stolen these stock listings, and their proof, SBTB, stood for Stolen by the Bee. So that gives you a glimpse into how he approached problems. So how did this personality, this very interesting person, get involved in this scrap situation? Well, to figure that out, we have to shift a little bit to July 1st, 1942. And here we'll put Henry and Margaret up on the screen. Margaret is going on a trip. So she asks Henry to drive her down to the train station. And on the way down, Henry does what husbands sometimes are wont to do when you're trapped in the car and there's nowhere to go. He complains. And this day he's complaining about the scrap metal efforts as well as the scrap rubber efforts. He's been reading in his own newspaper about the dire national situation, and he is disgusted at how Americans are simply not responding very well to the national government's pleas to gather scrap and to bring it in. Margaret quietly listens and suffers through his tirade all the way down to the station. But her last word is the final word. As she is leaving, she looks at him and she quietly says, Henry, what did you do about it? And then she's gone. Henry is touched and perhaps a little stung by her words, and so he goes home and he seriously ponders her question. What could he, Henry Dorley, do? It's true he was a publisher of a major newspaper, but he probably would have had little effect nationally. Not only is Omaha, and at the time was, a medium-sized city, and not on the coasts, and so unlikely to garner national attention in that sense, but in addition, he had established the newspaper as an anti-FDR, anti-New Deal voice. It had editorialized frequently against Roosevelt's programs and ideals. So it wasn't like Dorley could pick up the phone and say, hey, Franklin, I have some ideas. He probably wouldn't have answered the phone in the White House. But he realized that he did have a hidden advantage. He was in charge of the largest newspaper. By that time, the Bee had gone out of business in not only the city of Omaha, but the entire state. And the subscribers to the World Herald were spread not only across the city, but across the entire state. So he felt that if he could convince Nebraskans to set a scrap metal collection record, that the other states would notice and that they would be inspired to do so as well. So it was a kind of leveraging process that was going through his mind. And that brings us then to the third area that I'll talk about today, the Nebraska Plan, as well as its follow-up, the greatest treasure hunt in history. So one day later, July 2nd, despite being somewhat sleep-deprived, he had been up till 1:30 in the morning thinking of his plan, Dorley called a mass meeting in the Omaha World Herald building. All the employees were there to listen to the boss's latest crazy idea. He said, "Surprise, we are going to sponsor a scrap drive for 3 weeks, and our goal is going to be 100 pounds of scrap for every person in the state." And I have to imagine that a pin could have dropped in the newsroom, because that was an unheard-of figure. The previous record nationally had been less than 50 pounds, a small town in Pennsylvania. And here he wanted everybody in the state to gather over 100 pounds? Preposterous. But he was serious. He had some ideas about how it could be done. He suggested, of course, being a newspaper publisher, that there would be heavy press involvement, not just from the World Herald itself, but from newspapers across the state. He suggested widespread publicity outside of the newspapers and the radios. He suggested that we would have constant audio publicity. The two gentlemen in this visual actually went up and down the streets of Omaha for 3 weeks in the Metro Utilities District vehicles, using the loudspeaker to announce how important gathering scrap was. Constant reminders. Not only that, but we would have individual appeals with house-to-house and door-to-door canvassing. So people would be knocking on your door and saying, "Have you turned in your scrap yet?" Or, "The scrap truck is arriving tomorrow. Get your scrap out on the curb." He would also suggest that we would have a defined site, not only in Omaha, but in cities across and villages in across the state, where people could see the scrap gathering and collecting into a large pile and have a sense for the progress to that point so far. This was located at 11th and Jackson downtown. It's a parking lot today. Some of those buildings in the background do still exist, by the way. And eventually, after about a week or so, it came to be known as Scrap Mountain. Life magazine wrote about it. And if you had guests at your house for those 3 weeks in the summer of 1942, chances were that instead of going to see something at the local cinema, you brought them downtown to see what Life called the scrap pile that changed history. It was actually a tourist attraction. In addition to all of that, we're going to have daily entertainments of various sorts, rallies, traveling bands. Abbott and Costello showed up to be part of the drive. Here we see the Union Pacific rally held in the city auditorium, which I understand is just about reaching its last days here. Lots of history in that building. And that is the Union Pacific Drum and Bugle Corps playing up on the stage, patriotic songs. We also have visualizations. This was not part of the plan. It sort of developed as the plan went along. But here you can see Mrs. J.J. Stewart of the Florence neighborhood posing with her scrap. And you can see that she's holding, and I think my father and I decided this was a muffler of some sort. Did we? Tailpipe, thank you. You can see that I'm not so good at antique automobiles. So a tailpipe. And she's holding it not as if it's a tailpipe, but rather as if it is a rifle in the port arms position. And the World Herald liked this visual so much that it used it not only in a front page story, but also in a full page advertisement a couple of days later. And the headline for the advertisement was, "Omaha's housewives have gone to war." So you can see this idea that scrap is not just a piece of metal. It has become a kind of weapon. And that was the kind of rhetoric that they pursued during the war. Now, despite all of these ideas as part of the Nebraska plan, there was one vital element that was perhaps the most important of all, and that was competition. Think about this even today. What if Colfax County were to issue a challenge to Stanton County? And maybe there's an editorial in the Schuyler newspaper that says, "Colfax is going to beat Stanton County hands down at whatever the competition might be." Don't you think Stanton County would respond in some way? The towns and counties in this state have a lot of pride. And so Dorley had this genius moment where he said, "What if we put them all into competition? What if we measure, that is, weigh the scrap, count it up, and compare it?" So, for instance, in the drive itself, this is what happened. North of here, Washington County bragged right before the drive began that it would be the winner of the competition, hands down. But it instantly fell behind neighboring Burt County. And the local paper, the Blair Tribune, a Pilot Tribune, had this to say in a headline. Burt County puts Washington to shame in initial report, gathers 12 pounds per capita versus our 5 ounces. The story went on to say, there will be no bragging done this week about how well Washington County is doing in the big statewide salvage contest. The fact is, this county is not doing so well. And the way to visualize all of this, of course, is to list salvage contest standings. So starting in about the third or fourth day, the World Herald and newspapers across the state began to publish the standings. Every county's total to that point was listed for everybody to see, and you had a per capita lead. In this visual, you can see that at an early point in the drive, Hooker County was in the lead. It had gathered 26.45 pounds per person to that point in the standings. And so you can imagine looking at this and seeing your county being in third place and thinking, we've got to work harder. We want to be first. And if you're in first place, you think to yourself, we got to work harder. We don't want those third place folks to catch up to us. And if you're in last place, it's all the more motivation. So all 93 counties are listed, and it turns into a kind of horse race where the leaders change every day, and the newspapers talk about it as if it's a horse race. Here's the Norfolk Daily News. Down the home stretch come Nebraska's 93 counties today in the scrap metal collection race. Pretty exciting. They were pretty excited about it. As we get to the last few days of the competition in those 3 weeks, we have this testimonial from Editor and Publisher, which is a national magazine that did a feature on how well the scrap drive had gone in Nebraska. It said, "The ending found Nebraska working at fever pitch, with volunteer men and women scouring for scrap throughout the day and far into the night. Their labors recovered tons of dormant scrap, long-forgotten caches of metal, unsightly city water tanks, steel rail buried under folded riverbanks, bridges abandoned and forgotten, debris left after fires, and ancient tractors in farm gullies. It was a fitting finale," concluded the magazine, "for a campaign packed with fervor." Well, at last, after 3 weeks, the results were in. Our winner was Grant County, and the runner-up was Hooker County, both in Sand Hills Country. Grant County had gathered, are you ready for this, 637 pounds per person in that county. Hooker County was right behind with 541 pounds per person in the county, and those were both national records to that point. Douglas County did do pretty well. It wasn't among the leaders, but it was above the goal, over 100 pounds per person for every person in Douglas County. Statewide, the results were measured in tons. 67,000 tons were gathered by Nebraskans in only 3 weeks. That averaged out to 104 pounds per person across the state, which more than doubled the previous national record. Dorley's incredible and perhaps impossible goal had been met by Nebraskans. Now, Dorley's initial idea had been to set a new statewide record because his ultimate end game was national. So, the World Herald worked hard and it produced this booklet, the Nebraska Scrap Plan. And to my knowledge, only one copy of this booklet still exists. It is in the Duke University archives, in their advertising archives, and I came across it doing research for another project back in 2005, and that started all of this research was when I came across that booklet. They sent copies of the booklet across to the country to major newspapers as well as to D.C. And it turned out that it was seen by this gentleman, Donald Nelson, who was the head of the National War Production Board. And you better believe that very quickly he had Dorley on the phone. They decided that they were going to have a national meeting of publishers there in D.C., of newspaper publishers. Dorley was invited to speak to those gathered publishers, as was his assistant, J.M. Harding. The national drive that came out of that meeting was based on the Nebraska plan. And as I mentioned earlier, one participant dubbed it the greatest treasure hunt in history. The competition this time in the fall of 1942 was among the states. For 3 weeks, state versus state was what you saw in the headlines. But there were also local competitions. So you could have local wagers, counties and cities and so on, One of particular note was somewhat local here. Cass in Montgomery County in Iowa had a county-to-county wager in which the losing county's executive team was required to sweep the county seat of the victor. Montgomery County lost the wager, and so that fall, the streets of Atlantic, Iowa were a little cleaner, much to the chagrin of the Montgomery folks. So how did the states do? It turns out that our winner was also in the neighborhood. First place in the state-to-state competition was Kansas. Second place was the state of Washington. And third place was New Hampshire. And just in the geographical distribution of those states, you can see how widespread this competition really was. Nebraska was in the finals. It finished sixth place. But if you had approached a Nebraskan that fall and said, "Why did you only finish sixth? I thought you guys were good at this," that Nebraskan might well have said, "Well, you know, we already gathered 104 pounds per person, and that didn't count." So they would have had a ready response for you. Altogether, the states in concert gathered over 5 million tons of scrap metal for much-needed production in the arms factories, and that scrap was in place over the winter of 1942-1943, and winters, of course, are when you mostly need scrap because you can't gather it because of snow, and that sudden upsurge in scrap stores was pivotal in increasing arms production for the rest of the war, as well as going on the offensive against the Axis powers. But the heart of this increased production was the average patriotic American. And who inspired those Americans? Why, it was Nebraskans, of course. Nebraskans who in 3 weeks changed the course of history. And thanks to a 61-year-old newspaper publisher here in Omaha and his visionary, if not impossible, plan, the world was changed in some significant ways. Well, last today, I think we can return in our DeLoreans back to 2015. We can take a look back at how we are remembering the scrap drive. So here I stand on my soapbox a little bit and editorialize, because I think that from the distance of nearly 75 years later, as we think about what Henry Dorley did, as we think about what Nebraskans did in a more objective light, that it's an important story that we need to remember. Now, as we mentioned earlier, I've told a little bit of the story in the documentary Scrappers, How the Heartland One World War II, as well as in the book Prairie Forge, the extraordinary story of Nebraska scrap metal drive of World War II. And in working on those projects, what has struck me the most in retrospect is how quickly we've forgotten. To me, in some ways, it's sad how few people remember the scrap drive. It's sad how few people remember Nebraska's pivotal role in that scrap drive. And it's sad how few people remember Henry Dorley as our scrapper-in-chief. I find it incredibly remarkable that there are 500 historical markers in Nebraska, and not a single one commemorates the Nebraska Plan. I find it remarkable that our state capitol is filled with commemorative art, but not a single painting, sculpture, or mural commemorates the Nebraska Plan. In a state so filled with justifiable pride, we've made no room to commemorate one of our proudest moments. So let me conclude today with a bit of a challenge. 2 years and 13 days from now will be the 75th anniversary of Henry and Margaret's chat on the way to the train station. Isn't it time that Nebraskans finally find a way to memorialize an idea, a movement, and a visionary man who changed the world? If you agree with me on that perspective, those 2 years and 13 days are the time, and the clock is ticking. So perhaps once again, we should synchronize our watches.
Now, we do have papers and pencil at the center of the table for you to write your question down, and Gary Kerr will bring the questions forward. Are you ready, Dr. Kimball?
Yes.
All right. did housewives worry that some of their housewares may be disappearing without their knowledge? That must have been related to that family.
I'll step over to your left.
Yes,
here.
Please.
Yes, definitely. You had all sorts of situations where stuff was disappearing without permission. One particular, you may be familiar with Johnny Carson's Johnny Goes Home, I think it was, or Johnny Comes Home, his movie that came out in the 80s. In that, there's a scene where they're reminiscing about the scrap drive. And in Norfolk, they had borrowed Ballantyne Furniture's old delivery truck. And it turned out that the truck never reappeared after these kids were done using it. And all these years later, they're laughing about it. It turned out that on the last day, they brought in the last load, and they just left the truck there, and it became scrap. So this was true of businesses. This was true. Counties would accuse other counties of stealing things, and of housewives. You know, if your kid knew how important scrap was, your iron might go missing. And so if there was something you wanted to keep, you kept a watch on it.
Out of curiosity, I have a question for all of you. If you would just tell me by the show of your hands, how many of you were scrappers? I know that there are some from Illinois and the other states. It's wonderful. You're overwhelmed by Nebraskans in this audience. But at the same time, collecting scrap was an activity that was enjoyed and certainly profitable for the country. Another question. Why was this scrap drive forgotten?
I think there's a couple of reasons for that. This is speculation. I don't really know. But first, I would speculate that I think Nebraskans are a humble lot in some ways. There's this curious mixture of pride and humility here. And aside from trying to influence the national drive in the other states, I think there might have been a reluctance to brag, especially in light of a war going on. So you have soldiers who are going out and dying on battlefields. It might have been difficult in the face of all that was going on elsewhere to talk at length about what Nebraska did. And, of course, the war itself is a huge headline. So when you have Iwo Jima and you have D-Day and you have the atomic bombs, and you look back, usually historians are going to flock to those moments in the war itself. And because this happened so early in the war for the U.S., I think it became easier for us to forget about it. But I think we should change that.
And we have a challenge for 2 years from now. Do we accept it? Of course. How was the scrap transported?
There's a couple of elements to that question. One is, how did it get to a central collecting point, and often that was people power. Tom and I, my co-producer for the documentary, interviewed some folks out in Gothenburg, the Ostergaards, and Mary Ostergaard remembered, she was maybe 7 or 8 years old at the time, that she and her friend found a safe in the basement of somewhere they were playing, and they asked if they could bring that to the scrap drive, and whoever owned it said, sure, I don't need it anymore. And so these two little girls moved this big safe inch by inch all the way across town. It took them all afternoon. So people power, in many cases, you know, just hauling things. This was dirty business. So these were people who rolled up their sleeves and got their hands dirty, and at times got injured doing this kind of business. Now, once it came to a central collection point, usually a town's central collection point was next to the railroad. And so you had the infrastructure to be able to get it into the railroad cars and then down. I think often it went down to Omaha where it was sorted and then off to the various points, the steel factories and so on.
This leads to another question, which in part you've answered, I think, but did the pounds per capita of scrap include children?
Absolutely. Definitely. Now, it probably was the case that most children's totals, you know, paled in comparison to the adults, but the children were very much a vibrant part of this. Just to give you an anecdote, Margaret Hitchcock Dorley was instrumental in helping organize a cinema day, which was the last Saturday of the summer drive, where all the cinemas in the state agreed to have a free showing as long as you showed up and you had at least 5 pounds of scrap. And they were showing a cartoon or something, so the kids were attracted to this. And in Omaha, the piles across in front of the theaters were so big that in some cases they had to reroute traffic. So those kids themselves hauled stuff to go see that show.
I know of one person in the audience who confessed that he remembers hauling his little red wagon to pick scrap. And I think that there were smaller pieces, too, that amounted to a great deal of history. Question again. Did anyone try to determine how many tanks, guns, and similar that the collected scrap may have represented?
You know, they tried. It was difficult to do because you never really know where a given catch of scrap would go. So, for instance, you know, in wartime when you're trying to increase your steelmaking capacity, one thing that you do is you make more steel mills. Well, to create a steel mill, you have to have steel walls in the foundry itself or whatnot. And so the steel that you donated might actually have gone into a steel factory as opposed to turning into a machine gun or something like that. And so the process was sort of by definition mysterious as to where something specific went. Now, that being said, you would often see equivalents. So if you turn in this many pounds, that's the equivalent of a soldier's helmet. Or if you turn in half a ton, that's the equivalent of a Jeep and those sorts of things. But whether or not your specific donation went to, you know, a specific product was probably impossible to tell, even though they might have wanted you to think that.
You've told us a little bit about the background of Henry Dorley and how he solved problems, but also in a very special way that had some humor and some craftiness behind it. What I'm wondering is this, and someone in the audience has asked, did Henry Dorley change the political stance of the World Herald at the time from his father-in-law?
I'll confess I don't know too much about how his father-in-law ran the newspaper, so my knowledge mostly extends to how the White House was not a fan of the World Herald. In fact, I saw an interesting report. This is also from 1942 in the National Archives. Isolationism was, of course, a big issue prior to Pearl Harbor, and it largely disappeared after Pearl Harbor. But the same people who had been isolationists still were very willing to consider peace offers from Germany. You know, they didn't really want to be at war, even though they could understand why it was important. And so this report pointed out five or six cities that it felt were still pockets of isolationist sentiment, and Omaha was one of those cities. And so I think that may relate perhaps back to the World Herald's perspective, given that it was the largest paper in the city. And it seems pretty clear that the White House was not a fan of the World Herald and of Dorley in particular. So whether he changed his stance over time, I don't know if I can say.
I think Omaha is a big fan of Henry Dorley. I want to thank you very much for coming this afternoon, and Jim Kimball, for making the special trip back to your home state, and your relatives that you're visiting and are here with us this afternoon as well. Thank you very, very much on behalf of the Press Club. Certainly thanks for Dr. Kimball for finding an isolated and only one in the nation booklet while doing other research at Duke University, and then acting upon it. And isn't that what life is all about? Nothing happens unless you act on it. So we accept the challenge. In 2 years, maybe you'll come back, and we'll give you a scrap award. There we go. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's speaker has been James J. Kimball, Associate Professor of Communications and the Arts at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey, book review editor for the Presidential Studies Quarterly, and author of Prairie Forge, The Extraordinary Story of the Nebraska Scrap Metal Drive of World War II. He spoke on the topic, Scrapper in Chief, How Henry Dorley Unified a State and Helped Win a War. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 18, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, July 16th at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Matt Morton, Chief Information Security Officer and Assistant Chief Information Officer for the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He'll speak on the topic, Cybersecurity in a Global Economy, How Do We Assure Growth While Protecting Our Digital Lives? If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.